Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm Alex.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Benjamin.
And today we are going to talk about model positioning and positioning over time. So this topic sort of came out of a discussion of a specific concept in chess called forking, which is where, you know, say you move one of your pieces up into a place where your opponent can't really capture it, but it's threatening, say, both your opponent's knight and bishop. They can only really move one piece at a time. So whichever, like, regardless of which one they move, you get to get something really valuable out of it. And what this sort of sparked is thinking in terms of, one, how to accomplish this in War Machine, and then two, turn-over-turn positioning, and that really effective positioning doesn't just look like you're set up to accomplish this turn's goals, but you have clearly in mind where your models are going to be on the next turn in terms of like individual tactical movements and how this cascades backwards to inform your overall strategic thinking.
Yeah, and this is really going to, or we're going to try to really focus on the idea that most of the high-level tournament play where you're trying to win, the top tables are going to come down to a contest between people who understand basically space as a resource better, because we're going to assume that list creation and the balance of the factions they chose are pretty much on parity at that point. You're going to have some variables with the train, but really it's going to come down to how effectively you control space on the board, because most of the time at that level, you're not really going for the assassination anymore. Like the sort of like gotcha lists are already accounted for. So you're going to be looking at how am I going to get ahead on scenario? How am I going to contain my opponent from getting ahead on scenario? And how am I going to get the use I need out of each of my pieces every turn? And if a piece isn't positioned to do something, you're not getting any value out of it. And the value doesn't have to be immediate. You don't have to kill something with a piece every turn. And of course, some pieces can't kill something every turn. But the piece needs to be in a position to provide relevance, either by contesting or having the option of scoring or making sure that if one piece you have in position that you assume is going to get attacked, it will be able to follow up and take out the attacker if you're doing a piece trade scenario, or you put yourself in a position where your threat is enough to keep your opponent from moving into an area, which gives you the advantage. So, you know, that's the idea. And chess, it's easier because you can always tell whether a piece can or cannot attack a square at any given time. With pre-measuring now in War Machine and Hordes, you can get a similar effect where you know the radius of where people and, you know, all of your models can go and threat. And so it gives you a better option for planning. And the idea is we're going to look at, you know, the current 2017 geometry and the fact that 2018 doesn't look like it's going to change significantly. That positioning and the ability to contest without having to sacrifice becomes very important to keep the scoring pattern under your control. It will also help you identify if your opponent's doing that to you, because you're going to have a situation where, like, if you keep losing on scenario and you need to be able to identify why that's happening, and if somebody is simply just maneuvering and getting their pieces into position before you and you're not identifying that problem, it's going to be a consistent loss condition. And so we're going to try to work through, you know, how to look at that. Obviously, each army has its own idiosyncrasies, but that's not going to be as important as just considering, you know, what you're doing the turn after with a given piece.
Yeah, so like straightforward example to sort of illustrate what we're talking about. You have your scenario, which effectively dictates your opponent has to commit to certain positions in order to remain game relevant. Basically, they're going to move into the center and attempt to stay in the center. I'm playing a scorn list. I have Tiberian. He has a quite good threat range. He can probably kill whatever he's going after, but the list I'm playing him in has one other heavy. So, like, in order to win games and win that center, I need to have him be effective basically all the time. So his threat range is good enough that he can sort of be outside of other people's threat ranges. In order to have Tiberian be effective, it's not enough to position him to go after say, your opponent's lead heavy and start initiating a piece trade. The problem tactically is they can just move that heavy around his threat range, like, you know, cutting across the circle that he threatens, and establish a relevant place that also makes Tiberian irrelevant to the game. So getting the most out of him, you know, requires me putting him, say, threatening the lead heavy and threatening something else, be it another heavy or a unit which he can churn through. Like, you know, then my opponent has a much harder time not conceding essential board space to me and abandoning the position they're dictated that they have, and he has to give me something in effect or back off. So, like, that's, I think, the concept of a fork in War Machine. But knowing, like, you know, I'm deliberately positioning so that, okay, if my opponent does this, Tiberian goes here and attacks a heavy. If my opponent does this, he goes in and cleans out the unit. And I know I can be committed to either of those two positions, and this decision, like, informs me, okay, if I commit to this position, how does my army need to move to support that? If I commit to the other position, how does my army need to move to support that? Like, the next turn from now, when Tiberian goes in on one of those things, what do I need to do to establish he's safe where he will be? And this, like, making decisions like this around the moves that really make your pieces relevant, regardless of what your opponent does, cascades backwards. Like, that informs where my caster needs to be in order to move, keep Tiberian in, and be safe. That informs where my support needs to be, one, so they can get him to go there, and then two, so that they can catch up with him in his new position. That informs, like, where my RQREI need to be to deal with, like, counter threats and that sort of thing. There's a way of thinking that goes beyond the thing that's immediately in front of you to what's further down the road, and actually starts giving you really deep strategic insights rather than just, like, immediate answers to tactical questions.
So a classical example I've experienced back in the day, well, I guess this is less a fork and more just, like, planning things out and knowing what needs to happen. But back in Mark II, it was very common for Protectorate to have an iris off, where both sides had an iris that was crucial to dealing with the other side's colossal. And whoever got the iris first won the game. But if you also ran your iris to where she wasn't relevant, then it was the same as your opponent having killed her. Mm-hmm. So
you've also just described a lot of Mark I.
Yeah. But so just, like, understanding the dance of what your goals are versus your opponent's goals, if it hinges on a few events going one person's way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I can think of an example that happened a while ago at one of the tournaments where my opponent gave up the game because they didn't focus on the pieces positioning for the next turn. And they had a model with overtake, I had some infantry. They were murdering my infantry. They got caught up in the fact that they were murdering my infantry and followed the infantry out to a position that made that piece irrelevant for the game conditions for winning the game. And that's a situation where I know it's hard to give up murdering infantry because it's fun. And, you know, he had popped his feet and he had all this stuff going on and I got it. But I also realized as soon as he started doing that, that piece wasn't contesting anymore, nor was it going to be particularly relevant after that to threaten anything.
Well, so let me ask you, was there a way that he could have ordered his pack manning in such a way that he ended up in a position he wanted? Or was it actually that he chased the, like, the value so much that he gave up?
There was two things. One, he could have charged a model farther down sort of the spread I had done and then come back inwards. He would have given up basically killing three models, but then that particular piece would have been within easy charge threat range of the pieces I needed to score the zone, which would have put a lot of pressure on me. And it would have meant that I had to take out two heavies then rather than just the one heavy I needed to win the scoring matchup, which is a big difference, especially when I was low on resources after he was happily killing a bunch of my stuff. More importantly, that infantry didn't particularly threaten what was relevant on that scoring, other than just simply being there. So him chasing them down, that infantry wasn't going to kill that heavy. They were ranged infantry that wasn't really set up for that. I was just screening with them to screen effectively. Yeah. And that was a key. I mean, for me, that was the difference between winning and losing that game, is that he had sent that guy out there. I was able to then kill the other heavy, and I was able to score up and then win.
Do you think he was conscious of your scoring angle and just didn't appropriately catch it?
No, I think that he just didn't see it. He had the piece well positioned the turn before. It was actually a real problem for me. And then when he took off on the happy murder time, and I understand that. I mean, like, you're busy killing stuff. You're getting a great value out of your feet in the spell. And I mean, you're like, well, okay, that's good value. You killed the unit. Mm-hmm. But in that particular case, getting that value, he didn't see the positioning and, you know, left the piece off to the side. And he realized his mistake later when I scored up, and he's like, oh. But, it, you know, that's just one of those things you need to make that analysis that, you know, does killing the thing actually pay for itself if it puts me out of position? Or do I need to focus on being position relevant?
Yeah, there's like myopic blinders, like if you're just looking at the value proposition of like my models kill their models on sort of like an immediate tactical exigencies of the situation kind of thing. Yeah, you send your heavy in to kill a bunch of guys who don't really threaten it. But what you're not seeing is where that heavy needs to be for the rest of the game. And it just gets dragged off. Like, you scoot your survivors sideways, the heavy keeps chasing them, and then suddenly there's this big blank space where you just don't have to worry about it, and you have total liberty of movement. And like you said, your opponent could have managed his overtakes differently, or even just, you know, given up the chase.
Right.
And that would have pivoted it.
And quite honestly, if he'd been satisfied with killing, say, four models, and then with the last overtake sort of turned back towards the center, I wouldn't have won that game, in my opinion. Like, those two heavies would have been too much for me to handle. But the one heavy I was able to take out, and because the second heavy wasn't there to either threaten or make me pay, I was able to move my caster up in a way that would have been a lot more dangerous otherwise and put some damage on the heavy and then take it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've made mistakes like that before. I mean, I'm perfect. So, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes you do get too busy chasing down a model and you realize too late that you've really screwed up your positioning for the turn after that because you were just trying to get the stupid thing dead. Your dice failed you. You know, you brought up another model to handle it. And sometimes you bring up a third model to handle it, but suddenly you have a bunch of models that you weren't thinking about out of position. Where in reality, at the start of the turn, I had thought about where they needed to be at the end, and then I gave up on that. And that's a big tactical blunder on my part I've done a few times. Mark will remember a certain game where I totally borked the win by not paying attention to my final tactical movements.
I totally see exactly what you're talking about. And for me, like, making the switch back to Scorn away from Kador, I feel like I'm actually playing significantly smarter just making that switch. And I'll pitch and moan about Kador's power level all day, but, like, in reality, there's a lot of position-independent models like Widowmakers. They can kind of just be wherever. Versus Scorn, you're basically just exerting melee threat, and you need to be thinking in this manner to have the army tick over. Like, where does this need to be next turn? Where do the other things need to be to cover it effectively? Like, you're managing, like, this meshing, overlapping, like, sphere of melee death. And that takes, like, actually putting your brain into a gear that it doesn't have to be in if you're playing something that's a little more loosey-goosey attrition-wise, where you can just chase value incidentally. And I think you're also right that there are a lot of common misplays that show up, like people not positioning their heavies appropriately or not positioning their units appropriately. Oh, there's so many directions my brain is going with this right now, but I think one of the big ones is like the way your entire army has to operate as a unit, but you can get the way it has to operate from a couple of key pieces in determining what they need to be doing. Like you almost have to determine what are the models that are going to win the game for me or start attrition going in my direction, make the decisions for them, and then make the decisions for everyone else around them.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I know we've talked about this in passing before, the unpacking phase, like when you take your army out of the deployment zone and move up, which often is one of the most important turns of any of these games, because you need to be thinking where that piece needs to be on turn two, because right. Turn one is only relevant for most armies because of where you need to be for turn two. And I've seen us all both win and lose games on that pullout. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's definitely one of those things that, especially when you're flipping factions, becomes a real issue that you have to look after, because you really need to think, where do I want these pieces turn two? Where do I need them to be turn three, assuming that this and this survive, in order to put the pressure on him to win the game or her? And, you know, that unpacking phase, especially, you know, if you, let's say you got the role, you won the role to go first, you do your standard deployment, you know, your opponent then does something. Now you have to react to where they've placed their stuff, knowing their new threat values and what they're focusing on. And sometimes the right decision is to try to do a strong shift and change the matchup profile. Sometimes the right decision is to realize that you've essentially given up a side no matter what you do, and you cut your losses before you even start moving by knowing that you're just going to sacrifice pieces for the pure point of contesting, while hoping that going really strong on the other side gives you that positioning advantage. Sometimes, and I've played this game with a number of factions, your entire gambit is, I'm just going to be so aggressive in positioning that I hope that it stalls out my opponent long enough for me to win. And there's some armies that are designed purely to do that. You know, you can have a lot of fast, high defense cavalry that just gets up there, and you hope, not necessarily that they're going to clear the table, because they won't, but they'll force your opponent to spend enough time and enough effort trying to get rid of them that you win on scoring. And it doesn't have to, of course, be cavalry. There's plenty of other armies that have situational speed buffs that get things up there like crazy. You know, I know Doomy 2 is a favorite for that sort of tactic, where you just simply force your opponent to figure out how the hell to deal with that many heavies that are all of a sudden up there. But it's a good tactic, and it takes advantage of knowing that positioning radius. Because if you've already filled the center of the board with heavies, suddenly the math changes a lot. You're like, he's contesting and scoring everything that matters. Like, I now have to desperately try to get in there, but he already has a positioning advantage. And these are things, you know, to look for to counter that. Because if you had a model, you know, and again, this is where AD and some other things can be handy, to just block with, suddenly, you know, you can stump up some of that positioning advantage.
Yeah. I think something you said, like, it, a lot of it goes back to unpacking. And if you're in the position of being the person who's like, yeah, having to be more reactive or deal with a tactical problem that your opponent poses, it's probably because you're going second. And like, being masterful at unpacking your army and getting it into position rapidly is essential to consistently playing well going second. Like, if you can't do it effectively, you are probably going to lose. Because, you know, the player who goes first gets the first turn to move out of their deployment zone, unpack, and then the next turn they get to position again or engage. The second player has one turn to get their army completely unpacked and in position, because you may already be fully engaged by the time your second turn starts. Or, like, best case scenario, you start engagement on your second turn, whereas your opponents had two turns to set up and get ready. You need to be able to do it, like, immediately.
So that's something interesting I want to see with the Steamroller 2018, is they made it a lot more live, which makes going second more appealing, but they haven't done anything to mitigate the problem of first being such a bully right now. And I mean, that's just kind of a meta thing. If ranges get shorter and shorter, then you care less and less. But it'll be interesting to see when scenario becomes more live and lockout becomes more appealing and people really want to play second, how that's going to affect things.
I mean, I've for a long time been of the perspective that if you want to achieve a lockout scenario play, your best move is to go first. And I know, you know, a lot of people disagree with me on that.
I think it depends on the list. A lot of the traditional scenario lockouts don't want to go first, because they can't, like, physically block people out of zones very easily. They're about, like, pushing or removing or, like, doing things without destroying, where they can clear zones really, really easily, but they can't stop you from getting into them. Whereas a going first lockout game would want to revolve around not letting you get in there in the first place, so that you can score on their turn two, your turn three, and then it's basically over.
Yeah.
Well, another thing to think about, I know that this gives a lot of newer players and even a lot of, you know, players who've been playing a while a lot of trouble, is colossal sized bases. So the 120mm base has certain intrinsic positioning issues, because most of the time their movement value is lower because they're larger, so they normally don't cross the 6-inch threshold very regularly. I mean, there's obviously some exceptions to every rule, unless you're talking about the cavalry battle engines. But a lot of them are slow. They're high-value models.
And here's the really important thing that not a lot of people see, is they're slower than other models with the same speed value. Because one, like, they can't take a risk of being engaged first. And two, they slow down to shoot. They stop moving as quickly because they're firing.
Yeah, virtually all huge bases are firing platforms first.
Well, and the other problem is that they lose a lot of movement because you have to have a place to have the base be at the end. And that ends up being harder and harder the more models are around you. So you really have to plan where your colossal bases are going to be to turn two and turn three to make sure you're not blocking your own movements. Because I've had that problem before where I was getting all excited. I was moving some stuff around. Suddenly I realized that my order of activation was going to get really messed up because I had to move a unit I didn't want to move first in order to clear the landing area for my larger base to get the work done. And, you know, especially with... It looks like the new faction is going to have a lot of colossal bases. It's just something you're going to have to give a lot of consideration to, that your game plan needs to be, where is this going to be in two turns? I need to make sure all of my stuff is already out of the way so I don't run into activation issues. Convergence already has an issue like that. You know, the people who are good at playing the double tep lists spend a lot of time thinking out where the teps are going to go first, and then making sure they have the movement so they can move and do their sprays without having to worry about moving a ton of other things first or getting out of the way. So those are definitely one of the model types you have to give further consideration to. I mean, if you have one of them, or let's say you just have a battle chariot or some other faster thing, it solves a lot of that problem simply because it can get out of the way. But, you know, especially colossals and gargantuans, which tend to be in the center of your army to start with, you know, they tend to be like speed 4 or 5. You know, even if you have speed boosts, it really limits like where they can be.
Yeah, that's the faster huge bases you generally want at your flanks because they're skirmishers. They're gonna skirmish with the other usually lighter models on the sides and probably win. But yeah, a huge base in the middle of your army, like a colossal or gargantuan, which you are relying to hold your formation together, does complicate movement significantly. Like my Zirkova 2 list. I tried a variant with a colossal in it, you know, going from basically 2 destroyers and a couple of solos down to a conquest. And most of my army is fast. Most of my army is speed 9. Like, they'll get up there. But I found just having that huge base enormously complicated the movements of my army. Like, many, many, many disproportional, like, times. And it was so much more unwieldy because I needed to be keeping that constant space cushion around it. And it just changed the underlying dynamics of the way the army moved. Like, yeah, firepower-wise, it was a lot more effective, but the army's movement was so hampered by it that I opted to get rid of it because it wasn't working.
Did you feel that it was just a lack of knowledge of how you wanted it to go? Or was it actually limiting the options? Like, so for example, a lot of people, like a common adage, and I hear this from a lot of people, is, oh, if I'm a better player, I don't need tactician. But that's not really true, because you can go through your own stuff. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, it was definitely an example of it was actually amputating options. The center of my army had to move in a dramatically different way, and it slowed the formation down because I couldn't intrude on the conquest personal space bubble, as it were. Yeah, it completely altered it. And the tactician thing, like, back when it was basically Stannis Brocker was the only tactician that mattered, I think I agreed with that. Nowadays, spending a lot more time with Markov, I really don't.
Well, what about Irusk? You never played much of Irusk? He always have it, or was that a Mark III edition?
I think that's a Mark III. I only played Irusk in Mark II.
Always had it.
And I don't really remember much of it. But,
he had it. Okay.
But
and it was amazing.
I mean, like, specifically spending time with Markov, Mass Tactician actually opens up options for unbelievably complex plays.
Well, especially layered with the counter charge that you'll pretty much always see with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, the counter charge with Tactician, honestly, every time I play it, because, of course, I haven't been playing with factions that have any of those kind of tech. And when you flop over to it and you're like, oh, it's so good. Like, it just, it solves so many problems. You're like, oh, these guys are safe. until they're killing something, and it's awesome.
Or even like without countercharge, when I was playing him with Butcher, like, you threw a bunch of guys in to jam my 20-point cavalry unit. Well, Markov and the Iron Fang Kovnik will charge through them, kill all the guys that are jamming them, and then the unit will charge through them.
Can't flim-flam the Jim Jam.
Yeah. Another positioning thing to think about, which actually I see a lot of people struggle with, is when it comes to support. Mm-hmm. Now, support models are one of those positioning things where you really do have to think at least a turn ahead, because most support models need to be in position after they've already done their activation that turn. So, for example, let's say you have Beast Handlers or Choir of Menoth. They normally move up, they do their action, but you need to have them in a place where the next turn they can also still move up and do their action again.
And but you also need to balance that against people who have support hunters.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but that's one of those core things. And of course, trolls are very familiar with this with the stone bubble. Like, you really have to think out where you want it to be the next turn in order for it to be relevant continuously.
Although, interestingly, troll players, by the nature of self-sacrifice, are forced to play their support unit correctly. Most people are not.
And, I mean, it is one of those things, because, like, mechanics, you know, choir, beast handlers, any other unit like that, I know that Convergence has a bunch of guys and I don't remember their names. Any of those units, you really have to think the turn ahead, because I've played a bunch of support stuff before for giggles and found that if you're not aggressively moving them into pre-position, a lot of times they just simply never get to see functional use on the table because they're out of position all the time. And I think a lot of people complain about units not being useful, like especially mechanics, because they're not moving them up in a way that makes them be relevant when you need them. And of course, you can also have the corresponding thing with them where you have a situation that a lot of them, especially if they are a unit, you have scoring options with them. You know, people will often overlook them if they're not a high-value support unit. And of course, anything that has puppet strings, you have to be really thinking ahead of where you're going to need the puppet strings, because that can make or break a lot of attacks. And if they're in the wrong place, suddenly they're not giving you the edge that you're paying for. Yeah.
So that's actually something I want to try and get better about, is I pretty much treat puppet strings as only a buff, when in reality it can be used as a debuff. Now, admittedly, the Dunian Knot has a very low magic ability score, but if you can land that on a heavy that, like, is going to have a key turn going after something, like, that could make or break the game.
Yeah,
and I think I don't look for those angles.
Especially if the heavy is seeking, like, sixes to hit. That's where you can just break its back with that.
Yeah, I know that.
Or even just hold it for a spike on the charge or something.
Yeah, I know that the only time I've ever been successful using that offensively in my personal experience has been with the Withershadow Combine. Mostly because they tend to be around in the mid to late game when your caster is under threat, and a lot of times you have that guy kind of go up and be like, please don't kill my caster this turn. And it's actually worked for me, like, especially since the Crix casters historically have higher defenses, that puppet string could really make or break the chain on whether somebody kills your caster or not.
Who remembers command checks?
I do.
Puppet mastering your opponent's units and then running a void spirit around whooping at their army. That's fun.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Well, the worst thing is, I think back then, Puppet Master let you reroll a subset of the dice. Like,
yes,
if a die was
yes.
too high or a die was too low, you're just like, ah.
Yeah.
You got that 6 and a 1. Reroll the 1. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, but I remember that. That was super strong. I remember many a time in Crix killing somebody because I had puppet strings on my spellcaster.
Yeah, but returning to support, I think there's, so like Puppet Master, because of the length of its range, you can afford to be a little bit loosey-goosey because it has an offensive spell range, but it's also not perfect. I want to get back to Beast Handlers and Choir, because I see a lot of people play them in a way that's really suboptimal because they're not making these future turn positioning. They're not having these conversations with themselves. You know, what I typically see is, like, you've got a 6-man unit and they're basically spread out in a long, thin, like, curved line of 6 guys behind the army. But, like, There's a couple of things about that, like the positioning, because the leader is in the center, how far any of the models can stray from him and like leave their current position is actually really narrow. So the formation actually doesn't have a lot of latitude to move. And the other thing is, it's also incredibly frail to casualties. Like, if you kill a guy in a specific place, it's actually way harder to get someone else to go over and exert his influence, or exert influence where he used to be. So, like, for me, I see people, like, run a big beast brick, and they've got their beastmasters in a huge spread, and you just kill two of them, and suddenly, like, there's a whole range of their war beasts that are going to be way below par. Versus, you know, the formation that I started adopting is... you keep them centralized, like you keep them all together and you have them have lanes where, okay, they can move six to this guy or they can move six to this guy. Like, it's almost
drop an AoE four on them.
Well, yeah, I mean, but like it's almost like forking your own models, and you know, you have them centralized, and then you have beast handlers further back to act as casualty redundancies, and they can exert influence over your most important, most central models still. But you give yourself that greater flexibility by assuming a more compact position, and almost nobody does this.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest mistake I tend to see with those type of support units is they will only check to see if the support unit's within range for the turn they're activating them, mm-hmm. and not really move them forward. They'll be just within range of, like, say you have the choir, and, you know, like somebody took just a min unit of choir to buff their jacks.
Right. They'll send the jacks in.
Right.
And then the next turn, they've initiated the combat. Their pieces didn't die, but they won't be getting support, so they won't be effective.
Right. And, you know, that's if you're running two Reckoners, you know, whatever, you're fine. But if you're running some beat sticks and suddenly they're completely out of range, it's a bad time, especially I've seen people, you know, they barely move the guys forward, so they're effectively in their turn one position. And then the next turn, they don't have the opportunity to be within range of anything meaningful, so they either run or they just sort of abandon using the unit thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, it's better to risk taking casualties than to have them be irrelevant for the rest of the game. Like, I've gotten, you know, I've denied you value either way.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where the more centralized positioning comes in, is they're easier to protect and you have positional redundancy. But yeah, you're exactly right that they actually basically... when they're using, like, buff you go in abilities, they basically need to be moving past your original battle line to be set up to take over where your pieces land.
Right.
And this tells you a lot about, like, where they need to be turn over turn, especially for base-to-base healing abilities. Like, something you said pre-recording, mechanics need to be advancing aggressively constantly, or they will never be doing anything.
Right. And, you know, fortunately... most mechanics currently are priced at a point where, you know, if you take some casualties with them, it's just what happens. But if they're not at least within the ability to walk up and touch a model and fix the thing, there's no point of even having taken them at that point. Because mm-hmm. even if you're taking them to be a contesting / scoring unit, you honestly would have been better off taking something with a higher survivability for the point value.
Right, like a solo or something.
Or, you know, like a little 2-man merc unit or something with just hard to take off the table. But, you know, I've had a lot of situations when I was running my old witch lists where I had some mechanics in there. People weren't focusing on them because they were behind a bunch of Cawdor heavies. And so, you know, we're not talking about Lightning Leafs, obviously. We're talking about other armies. And, you know, it's one of those things where I ended up getting a lot of repairs off that people weren't really considering until it started happening, because I had been running the mechanics literally right up in the middle of all my jacks. And so then they were able to advance and repair, which was clutch in a couple of games. I mean, obviously, if we're talking about Filthy Signar, you have a totally different metric on how everything works.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that is definitely something, you know, when you're considering where the pieces are going to be the next turn, it's super important for those kind of units. And the Dunia Knot's another one. Like, you can get into the trap where, you know, you just sort of shuffle them around just enough to get that one turn of, you know, rerolls off, and then you charge out a bunch of things and they're not relevant to any of your heavies the next turn. And of course, armies with a lot of medium bases have the problem where you have to really pre-think where your stuff's going to be, because you can't really move through your other models effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like I've been thinking about this problem a lot lately too, because I'm doing Scorn, playing mostly Morgul 3, and my Morgul 3 army has like every single kind of like support archetype. So you've got the beast handlers, which need to function in this way we described in order to be effective, especially with a small battle group, because you need business out of them every turn. And then I have, an extoller and Marketh, and they generally have fairly long-ranged abilities, but in order to support each other or support Morgul or support whoever needs to do something, I still need to plan so that they can cut across and get their range to what they need to get it to. So, like, the extoller or Soul Ward needs to always be within 14 of where Morgul is to walk and guidance him. Or the Tyrant Commanders are like, I have to put way more brain sweat into those units than anything else because I have so many models that they can affect and need to affect. Is where do I put these so that no matter what happens, they can get to something as the situation develops? So, like, the commander needs to be within 10 of Morgul at all times and, like, within 10 of a unit or 10 of a clutch solo, you know?
Yeah. And I know that, I've played out games where running the list a few times, I ended up swapping models out, not because the model was necessarily a problem or it was a bad model, but its interaction on the table as far as movement and placement went made the model not work in the list I was trying to build. And, much like your example with the Colossal, there's been lists I've had where on paper, like, I had this really strong combination of stuff. The deliverable became a huge problem because the army got in its own way. But that only became evident once I started playing it into opponents that were denying me space to move my pieces. And I suddenly went, oh, wow, like, this is a big problem. Like, people who can recognize the threat of this thing and then counterplay, not to remove my piece, but to just simply stop me from getting where it threatens what he is concerned about, makes that piece a huge liability all of a sudden. And, there's a lot of models in this game that have come and gone from favor because of that very issue. Like, you look at them, they seem really good on paper. Like, the point cost is great. You're like, oh, that seems like a great model. But the reality of delivering it, with how space works in multiple turns, it just never pans out. Mm-hmm. And, that's one of those sort of undervalued issues when it comes to balancing models. And that's why, like, large bases with guns are always preferred over large bases with anything else, because large bases with guns provide the value they're expected to provide. Large bases that do other things have a lot harder time pulling their value back.
Well, and here's something interesting. Like, a large base with a gun versus a unit with a gun, This is one of those rules where, like, I'm sure we could deep dive into it and really explain it, but I kind of don't want to right now. Rule of thumb, like, heuristic. If you've got a 10-man unit and you kill 60% of it, the efficacy of that unit has dropped, like, 80 to 90%. Like, it can no longer exert, for most units, they can't really exert the real influence that they have. To deal with, a large base model with a gun, like, you usually have to kill it 100% to take that away. So there's some solidity and reliability there. This is also the killing 60% thing. It's almost kind of a Pareto rule, but this is how very small armies with a medium volume of attacks can outfight dude spam. You just need to know where to put them to neutralize their ability to do anything about you. A guy having his overtaking heavy chasing down a unit, like, if he already got most of the unit, he doesn't need to chase them anymore. They're done. They're out of the game. There's also, like, another unit type that obeys a totally similar rule, which is, like, small weapon master units. I know for a long time in Mark II, still in Mark III somewhat, like, people hate Knight's Exemplar. They do not like that unit, and that's because they're almost always playing it wrong. They're playing it in a long, thin line, like a big unit. Guys die off, they're no longer exerting threat effectively, they can't be where they need to be. People aren't taking the where-do-these-need-to-be next turn mentality. And I saw something that my brother started doing several years ago that was way more effective. He totally rethought how knights worked and, like, where do these need to be turn over turn? They're counterpunchers, so they basically need to be consolidating position rather than, like, grabbing it. So he set up his exemplar in, like, there's two guys, and then about 3 inches back, there's two more guys, and then 3 inches back from them, there's two more guys. And the position was always such that if a reach heavy came into the front two, the next two could come in and take out over half its health. And then the next two after that, and so on. Like, they basically fought in waves, and because he was only ever exposing two at a time, you couldn't make meaningful gains against them. This is another kind of moving, like, turn over turn thinking about your heavies, turn over turn thinking about these small weapon master units, or units that fulfill a similar role that people just aren't doing, in my experience. But you look at, like, players who are performing really well, they are generally adhering to some strategy like this.
Layering is definitely a very important skill.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and that has a lot to do with, you know, having a presence turn over turn where you're going to move stuff into. And
right, exactly. It's knowing, okay, next turn, these two guys are going to be dead, so I need to have the rest of my guys oriented around, like, actually achieving something that those two guys dying set up.
Another common example is vengeance units. I see a lot of people misplay that, where mm-hmm. they just throw everything in your face and they're like, yeah, I'm going to get some like free vengeance attacks off. But if you just put like two or three guys up in the front, like enough to be like threatening and annoying, and you put all the rest like 3 inches back from their normal threat range, you're like, either you let me do what I want with these three guys, or you get the entire rest of the unit to come after you.
Yeah, that was that was one of my favorite retribution shenanigans is... Okay, the soulless escort runs to max command range and is standing directly in front of your entire melee unit, and the Dawnguard sentinels are all the way back here going like, you got him, buddy!
Yeah.
We'll avenge you!
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I also that's another placement thing, too, that is very relevant. Vengeance units have fallen off compared to how they used to be, but it's definitely a position where I've seen plenty of people with vengeance units not able to take advantage of getting vengeance because they didn't plan to have a place to move their guys. And so by not thinking through what would happen once vengeance was triggered, they end up wasting a lot of opportunities because the model simply can't move into position to do much, mm-hmm. either because their own units are in the way or they just weren't in a place where that 3 inches of movement and their attack radius is enough to get any work done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a problem because, you know, a unit like that tends to be more expensive and you really do want to get the vengeance attacks off. And if you just misposition so you can't take advantage of it, you're giving up value to your opponent every time. That was our exciting take on forking and pre-planning positioning for future turns.
Anything else anybody wants to summarize with or bring up?
Yeah, I could segue this into like another whole thing about positioning, but I won't. I will say a lot of these principles, I can actually point to a specific game in War Machine that probably everyone should watch at some point to see actually how these strategies and tactics play out. It's Mark II, but it's still relevant because if you're looking for these principles, you'll find them there. The 2012 Lock and Load Iron Gauntlet Finals between Keith Christensen and Brandon Kading. You see all of these ideas at play, and if you really want to get a sense of what this looks like and how it turns into an effective game win, watch that video. Like, I think it should be essential viewing for anyone looking to up their game, because that specific game is extremely illustrative of, like, great play.
So there's your homework. We'll expect you guys to have all watched that by next week's episode, and we'll see you next time.
Wait, quick. We need to put that on our own YouTube channel and make money off this. Come on, guys.
We have a YouTube channel?
We should now. Duh. If we're gonna...
But by the time this episode's
yeah,
up,
yeah, we'll, yeah, yeah, well, totally. You should. And be sure to click on the advertiser link. It's super important for our future.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea? Email us at dominateforTwo.podcast@gmail.com.